Okay, this week is going to be a little, maybe a little bit confusing, because today, actually, I want to wrap up the conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union, the Cold War conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union, and how the Cold War ended. However, later in the week, what we'll do is we'll go regionally around the world and talk about what has happened in different regions around the world in the last 40 to 50 years. Now, in doing that, that means that we'll actually go back and talk about what's been going on, for example, in Latin America during the Cold War and after the Cold War. And then we'll talk about what was going on in China during the Cold War and after the Cold War. And then later on, we'll talk about what was going on in the Middle East before and after, or during and after the Cold War. But today, we're actually going to end the Cold War, end the conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union, and talk about how the Soviet Union collapsed and how the communist countries of Eastern Europe collapsed, and ultimately why the Cold War ended. So last week we talked about what the Cold War was, and hopefully you just watched this video to help on the slide previous to help you sort of remember what the Cold War was all about. Okay, this fundamental conflict between the United States and her allies and the Soviet Union and her allies, the United States allies being organized into NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, included Western Europe, Canada, Turkey, and then the allies in the Pacific being organized in CETO, the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization. Then the Soviets had their allies in Eastern Europe, which were organized into the Warsaw Pact, and then there was other communist countries outside of the Warsaw Pact, which included Cuba, China, Southeast Asian countries of Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and then some African countries, Angola, Ethiopia, Nicaragua, and in Latin America. So the conflict, again, is the communists versus the capitalists. Okay? Again, I emphasize this in class, I emphasize this in lessons previous. This is a conflict between the communist world and the capitalist world, not a conflict between dictatorship and democracy. The United States will frequently say that it's a fight for democracy, but really it's not at all. It's a fight with the economic systems. Remember that the United States and the Soviet Union never actually came in direct conflict. There were many what we call proxy wars, wars that were fought between capitalist and communist forces that got support from the superpowers, from the United States and the Soviet Union. But there was never any direct conflict between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Remember that the U.S. policy during the Cold War was containment. George Kennan had said that the communist system held within it the seeds of decay. Okay, and your sort of essential question for this lesson was he right? And if so, what were those seeds of decay? So let's start with that and talk about what the seeds of decay within the communist system turned out to be, because George Kennan was right. The system did ultimately fail on its own, never really requiring any direct conflict with the United States, although the United States certainly helped facilitate the collapse of communism. Okay, when the Soviet Union formed, it combined several different ethnic groups, several different nationalities. The Central Asians had been conquered by the Russians back in the 1800s. This included the Cossacks, the Uzbeks, the Tajiks, all the peoples of Siberia, but also down even previous to those conquests, the people of the Caucasus regions had been conquered by the Russian Empire previously in the 1800s, and even before that, the Azerbaijanis, the Georgians, the Chechens. And then during World War II, the Soviets, and just previous to World War II, the Soviets had annexed the Balkan states of Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, and then Ukraine had been made a part of the Soviet Union, as well as Belarus. Okay, so there were lots of different nationalities living within the Soviet Union, and what the communists attempted to do was create a new national identity. Instead of being an Uzbek or a Tajik or a Russian or a Ukrainian or a Latvian, you were a Soviet, and they tried to create this new nationality. that was Soviet. And what unified the Soviet people was the Russian language and the communist system. That was sort of successful. It worked for a while, but in the long run, those nationalistic identities, those ethnic identities resurfaced and led to a new form of ethnic nationalism rather than this nationalism that the Soviets had tried to create. Okay, so again, to reiterate this, previous to the Soviet Union, there were lots of different ethnic identities living within what became the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Okay, all those different republics were made up of different ethnic groups. The Soviets conquered all this area, or they included lands that had been conquered by the Russians previously, and they tried to create a new sense of identity, a new nationality, which was Soviet. It was successful, but with the decline of what had unified the Soviets, the communist system, then those old ethnic nationalities, those old ethnic identities, bred a new sense of ethnic nationalism, which ultimately led to the breakup of the Soviet Union and the creation of all of the different countries of Central Asia, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, and so on. And then ultimately the breakup of the Baltic states in Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, the Caucasus region with Azerbaijan and Georgia, and then Ukraine and Belarus breaking away from Russia. So nationalism was one of these seeds of decay. The ethnic nationalism that existed within the Soviet Union, but also existed within Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia, faced this problem as well. Limited funds, okay, that is probably the main catalyst to the ultimate decline of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was not able to generate as much wealth as capitalist systems were. The communist system in general, in whichever country it happened to be in, was not able to generate the wealth, which is calculated as GDP, gross domestic product, as countries with capitalist systems. Capitalist systems were able to generate more wealth, and that ultimately is what did in the Soviets, and we'll talk about how that worked in a minute. So the limited funds that could be generated in a communist system. Divisions within the communist bloc. Okay, communism as an ideology, when it was framed originally by Karl Marx and then further promoted by Vladimir Lenin and Leon Trotsky, one of Lenin's supporters, was this idea of world unity. This idea that communism would ultimately, the communist revolution would ultimately spread all over the world, and then the communist nations of the world would blend into one huge unified nation state, I guess, or one unified country. There'd be one world, system, and the whole need for different countries would sort of dissolve because all of the world's people would be unified by the communist system. And so when communism took over Eastern Europe and Soviet Union and China and Mongolia and North Korea and Vietnam, Laos and Cambodia, Cuba and Nicaragua, Ethiopia, Angola, when all these places became communist, it seemed quite logical, according to the Marxist philosophy, that there would be incredible unity among the communist countries. Well, the reality was is there really wasn't. A lot of the communist countries had a very difficult time getting along with each other. China and the Soviet Union had very different ideas on how the communist revolution should be implemented, and it led to conflict between them, actually armed conflict, a very short border war. Did occur between the Chinese communists and the Soviets. In Southeast Asia, the Vietnamese communists invaded communist Cambodia. Communist Yugoslavia refused to ally with the Soviet Union, actually isolated itself from the Soviet Union. Sometimes you'll actually see that the Iron Curtain, when it's drawn on a map, does not include Yugoslavia because Yugoslavia wasn't much interested in dealing with the Soviet Union. And rather than joining the Second World, it actually joined the non-aligned movement with India and Egypt. So there was quite a bit of division within the communist bloc. When we say communist bloc, we're talking about the communist countries of the world. They didn't get along as well as Marx had thought they would. Next was inefficiency within the communist system, which led to unrest among the citizens of the communist countries. The command economy of the communist system was very inefficient. It was very difficult for a central authority to determine how much of each good should be produced. Okay, imagine this on a practical level. You know, think about how many things are in your house. How many objects which have been manufactured in a factory are in your house? I mean, there's probably thousands, if not millions, of different things in your house that were manufactured in a factory. Okay? Then consider all the raw materials that went into the manufacture of all of those things, coming from mines or coming from farms. And now imagine that one central committee has to decide how much of each of those things to produce, how many toothbrushes to produce, how many razors to produce, how many sofas to produce, how many televisions to produce, how many radios to produce. And then not only how much of each of those goods to manufacture, but has to then figure out how much of each raw material needs to be produced. Well, we need to grow this much cotton. We need to grow this much flax. We need to mine this much coal and this much iron ore. Well, that's incredibly difficult to manage. And it's incredibly difficult to predict how much of each good you're going to need. How many toothbrushes should we make? Well, we have this millions, we have, you know, so many millions of people. Every one of them needs a toothbrush. They're all going to probably want a new toothbrush every year. So we need to manufacture this million of toothbrushes per year. Okay, well now we need to figure out how much raw materials each of the toothbrush factories need. But you're not doing it for each good. You're doing it for everything. So it becomes incredibly inefficient. And there's tons of people involved in this process. And it's very difficult to get all of these people on the same page and get them organized. Okay? And so you have the toothbrush factory, which has been told to produce this number of toothbrushes per year. Well, they have a hard time because it turns out that they don't get enough plastic to produce their toothbrushes from the plastic factory, because the plastic factory is getting not enough natural gas to make the plastic out of, or whatever. Okay. So there's incredible inefficiencies in the system, which leads to massive shortages. There were food shortages in the Soviet Union in the 1970s and 80s. There was major shortages of consumer goods. Okay, things like toothbrushes, it was hard to find stuff like that. You would go into a store in the Soviet Union, and they would have way too many of one thing. Like, they would have way too many paper towels, okay, but not nearly enough toothbrushes. They would have tons and tons and tons of hammers, but not enough nails, okay, because this central authority that was organizing the economy really wasn't, it was totally impossible for them to truly predict how much each person would need. A store in the Ukraine would have plenty of bread, while a store in Russia would be completely out of bread. Okay, because then not only did you have to determine how much of each good to produce, but then how to distribute those goods. Well, these people need this much of it, and those people need this much of it. Well, do they? You know, what's the demand in that area? Because ultimately, what it boils down to is the people, the individuals, have to make the decision. Excuse me. Go get it in the store. So what it led to was massive shortages. It led to waiting lists for goods, and it led to a general decline in the standard of living in the communist countries. Okay, so this system, which was supposed to increase people's standard of living, actually in some cases led to a decline in standard of living. Okay, there was an immediate increase in standard of living after the revolution took hold. But as the economy became more and more and more complex, that standard of living declined. And add to that the fact that now Western media, television and radio, becomes pretty widely available. people living in the Soviet Union can turn on ABC because they can put up their antennas on their TV, and the United States is beaming ABC into the Soviet Union, and so Soviet citizens are able to watch Western media. And they see on the Western media that it looks like people in the United States and people in France and people in Britain are actually living really good. And they don't have it that good. And so their government's telling them that we have the superior system. And the people look, they're frustrated because they have all these shortages, and they look at what's going on in the United States and they say, this doesn't seem like we have the superior system. Our system actually seems like it's not working like as well as their system is. Add to this the fact that there was corruption, abuse of power within the government and within these government agencies. Things like top government officials and party favorites, Communist Party favorites, people who were really popular with the Communist Party, would be granted privileges like being allowed to shop in stores that were stocked with Western goods. So only the who's who of the Communist Party would be allowed to have access to all of the goods they need. They got preferential treatment when there were shortages, whereas the masses of the people are dealing with inefficiency and shortages. Okay, so there's corruption, abuse of power. And then these governments tended to be really unresponsive to the demands of the public. They were not democratic governments. They were not free elections. So therefore, they didn't really have to be responsive to the general population. Okay, and as a result, there was general unrest. Okay. Example in the Soviet Union was the war in Afghanistan. The war in Afghanistan was as unpopular in the Soviet Union as the Vietnam War was unpopular in the United States. Well, the U.S. government finally had to yield to the public opinion in the United States because presidential elections came. And presidents were being determined based on where they stood on the war. Think about our country right now with Iraq. You know, presidential candidates are campaigning based on where they stand in the war in Iraq. But the communist leaders didn't. They just did whatever they thought was best and didn't really care what the people thought. So this led to widespread unrest. Okay. So the system was failing in the 70s and 80s. Okay. It was really starting to decline, particularly by the 80s. The Soviet premier at that time, or the Soviet leader at that time, his name was Brezhnev. And Brezhnev just refused to acknowledge these shortcomings within the communist system. He just completely ignored these seeds of decay, as they were called. And he just kept pushing on with this failed system. And so it managed to sort of be okay until the United States elected Ronald Reagan as our president. And Ronald Reagan abandoned the live and let live policy that had sort of taken hold in the 1970s. In the 1970s, the general attitude in the world was peaceful coexistence. That people had been kind of frustrated with the 1950s and 60s, with the Korean War and the Vietnam War and the conflicts that had erupted as a result of the Cold War. So by the 1970s, the attitude was pretty much peaceful coexistence, okay? We're going to live and let live. Let the Soviets and the communists do what they want. We are going to do our own thing, and we're not going to worry about them, and we're just going to let each group do what they want. Well, when Ronald Reagan came in, he just abandoned peaceful coexistence, and his mission was to end the Cold War and to do away with the Soviets. And so his policy was to essentially spend the Soviet Union to death. Ronald Reagan invested tremendous amounts of American money into the U.S. military and just built the U.S. military up huge, spent tons of money on missiles, tons of money on all kinds of military equipment. And the Soviets felt obligated to try and keep up. So as Reagan is spending on the U.S. military, the Soviets are in turn scared at our massive military buildup, and so therefore are spending on the Soviet military. Well, that made the food shortages worse, that made the shortages of consumer goods worse, and it made the standard of living within the communist countries worse, and it made the people of the Soviet Union more and more frustrated. And finally, it just ultimately forced the, it led to the Soviet system just ultimately giving in. Okay, this really came as a result of a threat by Ronald Reagan to build what was popularly called Star Wars, and that's actually the picture you see on the screen in front of you. This is a sort of artist's rendition of what Star Wars would have looked like had it actually been built. It was never built, and we're not actually 100% sure that we had the technology to build it. Okay, but Ronald Reagan convinced us all, I remember him doing it actually, that the United States was going to build a missile defense system. Okay, this is what he said they were going to do. The United States was going to put satellites into space that were going to be armed with lasers that would shoot any incoming missiles out of the air that were bound for the United States. Okay, so imagine this. If the Soviets launch their nuclear missiles at us, the U.S. satellites would sense the missiles and shoot the missiles out of the air with lasers. I mean, it sounded like the coolest thing in the world. We were so excited because we didn't have to be scared anymore, okay? And everybody was thrilled about this idea. They were just, I mean, this is part of the reason why Ronald Reagan was so popular. It was like such a relief that we didn't have to be scared of mutually assured destruction. Remember what had kept the Cold War from becoming a real war was mutually assured destruction. We knew that we could completely destroy the Soviets. The Soviets knew that they could completely destroy us. But we also knew that if we completely destroyed the Soviets, they would in turn completely destroy us, and vice versa. There was nothing to prevent it. Okay, the United States had its hydrogen bombs, these incredibly powerful nuclear weapons, on submarines that were patrolling all over the world, deep in the oceans. The submarines are nuclear powered. There was no way to figure out where they were in the world. They were all armed with these incredibly powerful nuclear missiles that could be launched from anywhere in the world and hit the Soviet Union. The Soviets had, likewise, hydrogen missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles, on trains that were constantly on the move in the Soviet Union. They also had these missiles and submarines of their own patrolling waters all over the world. So in the event of an actual war between the United States and the Soviet Union, these submarines would surface, the missiles would be launched, and both countries would be completely destroyed. So as a result, we never went to war because that seemed like a really stupid idea. But then Ronald Reagan says, don't worry, I've got this technology. I'm going to put these satellites into space. So these satellites will be all over the world. So it doesn't matter where the Soviets launch their missiles from. Those submarines can surface anywhere. It doesn't matter. Our satellites will sense the missile being launched and shoot it out of the air. So we'll be able to launch our missiles and completely destroy the Soviets, but the Soviets can't hurt us. It scared the Soviets to death. It thrilled the Americans. And the Soviets finally, just at that point, said, Uncle, we give in. We don't have the money to build something like that. We don't have the money to counteract something like that. We just can't keep up anymore. Okay? And this is really what just sort of brought the Soviets to their knees. Brezhnev was ultimately left office and was replaced by Gorbachev. Gorbachev realized the Soviet system was failing and tried desperately to save it. Okay? So let's go ahead and transition to the next slide, and we'll talk about the reforms that Gorbachev instituted in 1985 in an attempt to save the communist system. Okay, his reforms, there were three basic reforms, okay? Glasnost, Perestroika, and Demokratia, which I think is how I'm pronouncing it. I wrote I wrote on there for you in English, which is basically democratization of the communist system, okay? So reforms basically lumped into three groups, I guess I should say. Let me rephrase it. So Gorbachev's reforms were lumped into three basic groups. His reforms, which he referred to as glasnost. Glasnost sort of means the freeing. I think that's how you translate it. And these were social reforms. Basically, they allowed freedom of speech, They allowed the formation of some other political parties, I believe, and they allowed people to criticize the government and to criticize the Communist Party. Okay, I'm not actually sure they allowed the formation of other political parties. I'd have to check on that. I'm not sure. But it definitely allowed freedom of speech. Okay, so now Soviet citizens were allowed to actually criticize their government. They were allowed to speak publicly against their government. The media was allowed to actually say things contrary to the government. And people were allowed to criticize the Communist Party. Okay. Next group of reforms, called perestroika. Perestroika were economic reforms. Okay. And basically, this was an effort to decentralize the command economy of the Soviet Union. Okay. Rather than all decisions, economic decisions being made by a central committee in Moscow, now local plant managers were allowed to decide how much of a good to produce. Stores were allowed to decide how much of certain goods to order. And basically, it slowly, and on a pretty basic level, allowed the beginnings of a free market system. Okay. Factories were allowed to decide how much of a good to produce based on how much demand there was for a good. Okay. Stores were allowed to order goods based on how much demand there was. So it allowed local control of production, local control of the economy. And then lastly, the democratization of the Soviet system. Not a complete democratization at all. The central government was still completely controlled by the Communist Party. However, Gorbachev allowed local elections. Okay, he allowed the election of the local governments in each of the Soviet republics. Okay, the Soviet Union was divided up into republics, and essentially these are like states in the United States. Okay, the United States is divided up into states. The Soviet Union was divided up into republics. Okay, and he allowed the election of mayors. He allowed the election of presidents of each of the republics. So the Gorbachev's title was premier, okay? And then the title of the leaders of each of the republics was president, okay? So don't get confused by that. The largest of the Soviet republics was Russia, okay? That Russia still existed, but it was now one republic within the Soviet Union, the largest of the republics within the Soviet Union. The election of the president of the Soviet Union was perhaps the most colorful. You can actually see here one of the campaign appearances of this fellow. His name is Boris Yeltsin. He's the guy there dancing with the young lady there on his right. And he was a big drinker and kind of a strange guy. And he ran for election, ran for the office of president of Russia, and won. And became particularly important in the ultimate fall of the Soviet Union, which we'll talk about next. So let's go ahead and transition. Okay, so the Soviet communist system instituted these reforms under Gorbachev in the mid-1980s and managed to hang on for a little while. But it was further undermined by the weakening of communism outside of the Soviet Union, particularly in Eastern Europe. We already know that Yugoslavia and China didn't like the Soviet Union and weren't under the sort of control of the Soviet of Soviet domination. But the Soviets did manage to dominate the political affairs of the Warsaw Pact countries like Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Bulgaria. The first of these countries to sort of publicly reject communism was Poland, and it came from a movement within Poland called Solidarity. What's ironic about the Solidarity movement was it was a labor movement. It was actually the labor unions of Poland had all gotten together and formed this organization called Solidarity. And Solidarity fought for major reforms, not physically fought, but protested, worked for major reforms to the Polish system. This ultimately led to the Polish government in 1981 declaring martial law and arresting most of the leaders of the Solidarity movement. However, this didn't stop Solidarity. Solidarity managed to remain an important political influence in Poland, despite the fact that the Polish government had cracked down on it in 1981, and it really started the movement of Poland away from communism. Add to that the fact that in the late 70s, a Polish bishop was named Pope, or a Polish cardinal, I should say, was named Pope, and Pope John Paul II, I believe, was Polish, and so the Catholic Church in Poland started to really work to undermine the communist system there. When Gorbachev instituted his reforms, this really showed that the Soviets had problems of their own and were not necessarily going to be able to maintain the communist systems of Eastern Europe if the governments of those countries became weak. So when the Soviets instituted their reforms, this led to major changes in Eastern Europe. And the Eastern European countries, the governments of the Eastern European countries, realized that the Soviets were having so many problems of their own that they couldn't really rely on the Soviets for aid anymore. And so many of the Eastern European countries then started to turn to Western countries like the United States for aid. They started doing business with the Eastern European countries. They started receiving financial assistance from the United States. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. The Eastern European countries The Eastern European countries realized that the Soviet Union was in trouble. Okay. Therefore, rather than turning to the Soviets for help like they always had, they started to turn to the West for help. Okay. Turning to countries like the United States, the British, the French. They started doing business with Western European countries and with the United States. So trade opened between Eastern Europe and Western Europe and the United States. So the Iron Curtain is starting to collapse. They received financial support from the United States. So the United States gave financial aid to Eastern European countries. And they allowed travel, which is perhaps one of the most important things. The Eastern European countries allowed Western Europeans and Americans to come into these countries. I remember when I was young, one of the funniest things that happened during this time period was the fact that when Americans would travel into the Eastern European countries, they could take a pair of Levi's with them, and they could sell a pair of Levi's for enough money to actually go buy a car in one of these countries. So the big joke was, is if you were going to travel in an Eastern European country, you didn't need to rent a car because you could just bring some Levi's with you, some jeans. And these things, Levi's were in such high demand because they were completely unavailable in Eastern Europe, because remember, they had all these shortages of consumer goods, that you could sell a pair of Levi's for enough money to buy a car, because there were plenty of cars, but there weren't any cool clothes. So apparently people were willing to pay tremendous amounts of money for Levi's, and then cars, which were widely available, were so cheap that you could use that money to buy a car. So what this really did, and the point of the story is it exposed the Eastern Europeans to Western Europe and American culture and success of the capitalist system. When Western Europeans started to travel into Eastern Europe, they said, wow, these guys like have good lives. They have money and they have nice clothes and they're successful. We really ought to get away from this communist system, because obviously the communist system isn't working. Those people in Western Europe are much better off than we are. And it really inspired the Eastern Europeans to rise up against their communist governments. So ultimately, by 1989, communist governments were falling all over Eastern Europe. And in November of 1989, the physical symbol of the division between the communist world and the capitalist world was finally taken down, the Berlin Wall. Remember that the Eastern Germans, the communist Eastern Germans, had to put a wall up, actually, to keep their people in the city of Berlin. And finally, in 1989, the Eastern German government, the East German government, said that they would allow East Germans to travel into West Germany. And so as soon as the announcement came, East Berliners climbed over the wall into West Berlin and both East Germans and West Germans actually started to disassemble the wall themselves. You can see this in the picture in the bottom left-hand corner. So throughout, like I said, throughout Eastern Europe in 1989, leaders allowed reforms in the form of elections. So leaders of Solidarity were elected in Poland and dismantled the communist system there. A writer of political books that complained about communism in Hungary was elected. The Czech Republic, communism fell in the Czech Republic and in Bulgaria, all relatively peacefully, not completely peacefully, but relatively peacefully. The Romanian dictator, communist dictator, attempted to maintain power, but he was arrested and ultimately executed. So the Romanian communist government fell. By 1990, elections had brought non-communist governments to power in all of Eastern Europe. And communism ceased to exist in Eastern Europe by 1990. The Eastern German government, the communist government, lost power in Eastern Germany, and Germany was reunified in 1990 and became one country. Also in 1990, the Baltic states of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia declared their independence of the Soviet Union. So the Soviet Union started to break up as early as 1990. With Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia declaring their independence and once again moving away from their communist governments. Nationalism exploded in the Caucasus regions of Georgia and Azerbaijan, and Azerbaijan and Georgia started to demand their independence. And then in 1991, the Soviet Union finally collapsed. It's kind of a complicated story, so listen real close so I can explain what happened. Gorbachev had become very unpopular with the hardline communists because what they actually believed was that Gorbachev was dismantling communism in the Soviet Union, which in fact in some ways he was. So what happened was is that the hardline communists in the Soviet Union organized a coup d'etat. Remember that a coup d'etat is a forceful overthrow of the government. So the hardline communists sent tanks into Moscow to seize power from Gorbachev, to overthrow Gorbachev and to seize power in an attempt to reestablish pure communism in the Soviet Union. Well, the tanks rolled in to Moscow, and the people, led by the president of Russia, Boris Yeltsin, the democratically elected president of Russia, the Republic of Russia, met the tanks and stopped them. Yeltsin actually climbed up on a tank and basically opened the tank door and said, "Stop." And the people flooded the streets and stopped the coup d'etat. So because of his popular support by the people of Russia, Boris Yeltsin was able to stop the coup d'etat organized by the hardline communists to overthrow Gorbachev and reinstitute communism in the Soviet Union. Okay, so let me run through that real quick again because I know it's a bit confusing. Remember that the Soviet Union is divided up into a whole bunch of republics. The largest of those republics is called Russia, or was called Russia. Gorbachev had allowed democratic elections in each of the republics. Each republic was allowed to democratically elect its own leader, which was called a president. Okay, Russia had elected Boris Yeltsin. Gorbachev was systematically reforming the communist system. This made the hardline communists angry, so they organized a coup d'etat to overthrow Gorbachev and to pull back his reforms and to reinstitute pure communism in the Soviet Union. So they sent tanks into Moscow to try and overthrow Gorbachev, to try and reinstitute communism, pure communism, I should say. Boris Yeltsin went into the streets, gave very passionate speeches. The masses came out, surrounded the tanks. Boris Yeltsin climbed up onto the tank, which you see in the picture in the upper right-hand corner, and from the top of the tank gave a very moving speech in the streets filled with people, and the coup d'etat was stopped, and the communists were not able to seize power. At that point, the Congress of the People's Deputies, which essentially was the legislative branch of the Soviet government, voted to dissolve the Union, and the Soviet Union ceased to exist in 1991. With the Union dissolved, each of the republics became independent countries. So we got what you see in the map in the upper left-hand corner. Rather than one big, huge country, we ended up with several smaller countries: Russia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Ukraine, Belarus, and so on. These countries remained very, very loosely united into what's called the Commonwealth of Independent States, but really, for all intents and purposes, they're completely independent at that point. Nationalism really leads to this complete independence. Nationalism also resurfaced after this in, and largely inspired by this, in Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia. Czechoslovakia peacefully broke up into the Czech Republic and the Slovak Republic, and Yugoslavia, Slovenia, and Croatia declared their independence, and ultimately Yugoslavia broke up in a very bloody and violent war in the 1990s into several smaller independent countries. So that is the collapse of communism in the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe. Okay, so we are done.